it's Diane. Great to be with you on My Mind This Week. It's been 50 years since Robert F. Kennedy was assassinated. On Wednesday, I spent the morning at Arlington Cemetery. It was a gloriously sunny day, and as many as 1,000 people or more were present, including his widow, Ethel, who just celebrated her 90th birthday. Her grandson, Congressman Joe Kennedy III, pointed out in his remarks she still wears her wedding ring. For the show this week, I spoke with Kennedy's daughter, Carrie. She's been talking to some of the biggest names in politics, business, and entertainment about her father's legacy. What she found was that Bobby Kennedy's message still feels surprisingly relevant. Carrie has pulled together these conversations into a new book, Robert F. Kennedy, Ripples of Hope. The title comes from a speech her father gave in South Africa in 1966 at the height of apartheid.
Each time a man stands up for an ideal or acts to improve the lot of others or strikes out against injustice, he sends forth a tiny ripple of hope, and crossing each other from a million different centers of energy and daring, those ripples build a current which can sweep down the mightiest walls of oppression and resistance.
Carrie Kennedy, it's good to have you here.
It's great to be here. Thanks, Diane.
50 years ago, your father was shot dead. You were 8 years old at the time. And yet, you see his messages as absolutely relevant today. Talk about those messages.
Well, you know, when Daddy ran for president, he said, peace, justice, and compassion towards those who suffer. That's what the United States should stand for, and that's why I run for president of the United States. Try to imagine an American president saying peace, justice, and compassion towards those who suffer. Those are messages that are so far apart from what we hear today and yet so needed in our country and in our world. He ran for president in 1968 at a time when our country was so severely divided.
Yes.
At no time since then, in the last 50 years, have we been as divided as we are today, as we were then. But, you know, after Dr. Martin Luther King was killed, 125 cities were in flames.
I remember.
There were protests against the Vietnam War. There was this enormous anger and rage between old and young in our country, black and white, rich and poor. And Daddy's campaign was really about trying to heal those divisions, about finding common ground, about bringing our country together.
He also talked way back then about guns.
He did. He spoke in Oregon about the need for reasonable gun control in the very, very town where 40 years later there was one of the mass killings. And he said people who do not have the emotional capacity to be responsible with guns shouldn't have them. And he talked about his own brother being killed. And I'm so proud that we are giving the Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights Award this year to the students from Parkland, along with three other groups of student leaders in our country because of their work.
I'm interested in how you chose the people that you talked with or who wrote about your father in this book, Robert F. Kennedy, Ripples of Hope.
Well, I was really looking for a variety of people. I wanted people who considered my father a hero and who have had an impact on our country and on the wider world, and from a range of different places. So politics, it's Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. From the corporate world, it's Howard Schultz and Tim Cook. From entertainment, it's Harry Belafonte, Bono, George Clooney. And then, of course, there's really wonderful women like Gloria Steinem, who actually covered my father when she was a journalist in New York, LaDonna Harris, the great Native American leader,
yes.
And many others.
Carrie, through your interviews in this book and through what other people have written, what were some of the common themes that you heard?
Well, people talked about my father's courage. They talked about his moral imagination. This is the capacity for empathy at times that were very highly intensive. His moral imagination saved us from nuclear annihilation during the Cuban Missile Crisis, because Premier Khrushchev was at the time had all this rhetoric about war. But my father, along with my Uncle Jack, were able to understand that Khrushchev had his own Soviet military-industrial complex, which was forcing him into that position. And they understood that he personally actually didn't want to go to war and he would like to find a way out. And because they were able to imagine what Khrushchev was doing, they were able to save us from war. This came up again after Dr. Martin Luther King died, and Daddy was facing a crowd, about 1,000 people, in Indianapolis that very night on April 4th.
I have some very sad news for all of you.
The people in the front of the crowd had come early, so they hadn't heard the news. This is before cell phones.
And that is that Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis, Tennessee.
The people in the back of the crowd had heard the news, and they came equipped with Molotov cocktails and bicycle chains, and they were ready to riot.
Martin Luther King.
And Daddy stood up in front of that crowd and said, for those of you who are angered by this injustice, I can say I have that same sort of feeling because I had a member of my own family killed.
I would only say that I can also feel in my own heart the same kind of feeling. I had a member of my family killed.
Now, try and imagine a politician standing up in front of a group of people who are ready to riot and saying, I understand your feelings. Wow. And then he said, but what we need in the United States is not division. What we need in the United States is not violence and lawlessness, but compassion towards those who suffer and a sense of justice.
What we need in the United States is not hatred. What we need in the United States is not violence and lawlessness, but is love and wisdom and compassion toward one another, and a feeling of justice toward those who still suffer within our country, whether they be white or whether they be black.
And that night, 125 cities across our country started to burn, and Indianapolis remained calm.
Isn't that fascinating?
It's amazing, but that's the same thing he was doing with Khrushchev. It was that ability, it's that empathy, it's that ability to see yourself, see the other person's perspective.
It does seem to me that empathy is something that's sadly lacking in today's politics, in today's entire environment between the press, the politicians. It's the other, somehow, that we don't get.
Yeah, I think, you know, this was something that was so important to Daddy. Even as a child, I remember, and I talk a little bit about this in the book, him trying to teach us, his children, about empathy. Whenever we had a battle, and we had a lot, because I had 7 brothers and 3 sisters, and he would always follow the same course. And I remember one time I was fighting with my brother Michael, We were playing World War II in our magnolia tree.
And was throwing those
blossoms. He was throwing magnolia pods at me, which looked like hand grenades but feel like rocks. And he was the Americans up at the top of the tree. I was the Germans losing the battle. And he hit me too many times, and I ran up to my father's study, and I jumped into his arm.
Which you weren't supposed to run into.
Exactly. You're not allowed.
Unless it was very important.
Exactly. And he and Daddy said, go get Michael, and I ran and got my brother, and I thought, justice will be done. And I brought him up there, and Daddy said, now, Michael, you be quiet, and Carrie, you tell your side of the story, and I did. And then he said, now, Carrie, you be quiet. And Michael tells his side. And through that process, I realized I wasn't all right and he wasn't all wrong. And then he made us kiss and make up and go to our rooms and read for an hour. And, you know, what he was doing is he was getting us to see that you have to see your enemy as your brother or your sister. And that was his, that's how he conducted his entire life. And that each of us is responsible for peace, but you have to see things from the other person's perspective. You have to take the time to understand that.
Awfully important that there were so many newspapers in the house, and they were in part required reading for you kids because there would be kind of quiz at dinner.
Well, yes, exactly. So breakfast, we had five or six newspapers on the table and several magazines, you know, another five or six or seven magazines. And we had to read those. And then at dinner time, we would go around the table and everybody had to say one article they read that day. And you couldn't repeat what somebody else had written.
So depending on where you were seated.
Yeah, it was very strategic seating. But, you know, and then a discussion would ensue, and my father really wanted us to articulate how we felt on issues, to hold up our arguments, to engage in debate with one another.
What do you believe are the specific life lessons that you take from both your father and your mother and carry on today?
Well, I think the belief that one person can make a difference and that you must be engaged, you got to be engaged. And not that you have to because it's some sort of punishment or duty, but because that's just the way to have the most fulfilling and fun and interesting and wonderful life. I mean, I think that's the way both of them lived their lives.
Where were you on the day he died?
I was out in California. We had been campaigning. Daddy always loved to take all the kids campaigning, and he made a huge effort to make it fun. So he had brought us all to Disneyland a couple days earlier, and then we had been campaigning in Watts and in the Latino part of Los Angeles. And then that day, on June 4th, we went over to a friend's house who lived on the beach, and we all went swimming. And then the events at the Ambassador Hotel happened. The younger kids, including me, I was 8, were sent back to our hotel before, you know, we had to go to bed. And so I heard the news because the next morning I woke up probably 4 or 5 in the morning to watch, because I was still on East Coast time, to watch cartoons. So I walked into the living area of that hotel room and turned on the TV and then flashed across the television. So that was pretty tough. And then we went home to Hickory Hill. We flew across the country, the younger kids. And that was June 4th. We flew home June 5th, and then he died on June 6th. And I remember my brother Joe called and told me that news. And I went to my room, and I laid down on my bed, and I prayed for my father. And, you know, we had this very strong image of heaven as being a wonderful place to be. So I thought about him with Uncle Jack and with other people who had died who were close to us. In that wonderful reunion. So I prayed for him. And then I prayed for the person who killed him. And I didn't know it was Sirhan Sirhan at the time, but I just prayed to God that nobody would harm him because I just wanted the violence to stop.
What do you think he might have been able to accomplish had he been elected president?
Well, I think, first of all, we would have gotten out of Vietnam 4 years earlier, saved a lot of Vietnamese lives, saved so many American lives. So I think that's the first most important thing. Second, Daddy's whole thrust of that campaign was really looking at two issues. One was healing divisions, and two was addressing poverty in our country.
Poverty, absolutely.
And so I think that when you look, so when Nixon came in, we had Watergate, that whole thing that was so horrible, hard for our country, such a crisis for our democracy would have been avoided. But probably more importantly, Nixon's Southern strategy, where he sought to divide our country based on race in order to maintain political control, would have been avoided. In fact, the opposite would have happened because Daddy would have been all about bringing people together, not dividing. That strategy was then compounded by Reagan, and after Reagan really compounded, and ultimately by Donald Trump, who's, you know, I grew up in a political family. The easiest way to get elected is by appealing to people's fear and anger and hatred. And that's what got Donald Trump elected president of the United States. It wasn't because he had some visionary view of what we should be. It's because he was appealing to people's anger and rage. And I think with my father, he would have brought us together in a way that would have made that type of divisiveness very difficult to achieve. And then a big part of our structural division today is because of income inequality and because of the pain and suffering in specific areas of our country. So that's among immigrants, among Native Americans, among whites in Appalachia, and among inner-city African-American groups. Those were his, that was his gang. You know, those were all his people and who he cared so much about and were, and I think as president, would have put in enormous time and effort.
Carrie, how do you feel about the fact that your brother has been saying that Sirhan Sirhan was not the assassin of your father?
Diane, to tell you the truth, I pay no attention to it at all. I haven't talked to Bobby about it. I know that these things are floating out there, but I really like to focus on my father's life. The reason we're interested in his death is because of what he did in his life.
Of course.
And that's what I find a source of inspiration. And a source of inspiration specifically for facing the social justice issues in our country today.
But one has to wonder what it is that has led him. He has said he's visited with Sirhan Sirhan.
You know, again, Diane, I can't even comment because I haven't read it. I don't care about it. I really don't. It's not my...
And you haven't even talked to him.
No, I don't. That's not something I have any one scintilla of interest in. I avoid it. I don't want to know about it.
I
want to focus on what's positive and also the difficulties that are facing our country and our world today, which are so much greater and so much more important, frankly, than that
Indeed.
Issue.
You know, Carrie, I was very proud to chair the Robert F. Kennedy Journalism Awards 1 year. So in my office, I have this beautiful bust of your father's head, which I regard as a very, very special monument to him.
That is so nice of you to recall, Diane. You know, those journalism awards were so interesting because They were started by a group of journalists who followed my father during the 1968 campaign. And nowadays, there's such tension between journalists and the candidates that they cover. But that campaign was just such a rollicking good time for everybody on it. And what happened when I've heard this, Gloria Steinem talks about it in the book, but others have told me this throughout my life, that journalists would come to cover my father with this sense of skepticism about him. And then they would sort of fall in love with him. And then they would go to their editors and say, you have to take me off the campaign because I cannot be objective anymore. And so in some ways, he got harsher treatment than he probably deserved. But after he died, those journalists came together and came to my mother and said, we want to start a journalism award in honor of Robert Kennedy, which goes to journalists who cover the social justice issues that were so important to him. And they're continuing today.
Tell me about the organization you have established in memory and in honor of your father.
So as you're saying, the Journalism Awards were really the start of it. And they are known as the Poor People's Pulitzers. And people who win them are very, very proud of that. We have, today we have three major programs. So one is we hold governments accountable for human rights abuses through litigation and advocacy. So when Uganda passed a law that made homosexuality punishable by life in prison without parole, we partnered with local lawyers on the ground, sued the government, and overturned that law. And we have similar cases all over the world. We have about 30 at a time, and we've never lost a case against governments, mostly in Latin America and Africa, but also in other countries. That's one piece of it. But today, of the 100 largest economies on Earth, 50% of them are corporations. So if you care about human rights and you're not involved with corporate social responsibility, you're really missing a big chunk. So we work on corporations not through the corporations themselves, but through the owners of those corporations, through the sovereign wealth funds and big pension plans that own them.
So what does that mean? How do you choose a focus in a particular country?
So, well, with the corporate piece of it, we're looking at three different areas. We're looking at supply chain issues. We are looking at who is making the investments, and we're looking at the right to privacy, the right to freedom of expression, and access to information, that troika. But in the area of who's making the investments, we're not asking if the companies are women and minority-owned firms. We're asking, who are you hiring to make those investments, make the decision of which companies to invest in? So, for instance, we brought together the top 30 endowments, the largest 30 endowments by universities in our country. Okay, so it's like Harvard, all Yale, right, Stanford, et cetera. And we asked them, what percentage of your endowments are invested by women and minorities? And you know what the answer was? Less than 2%. So this is, you know, this is like Alabama in 1956, 98% by old white men, less than 2% by women and minority-owned firms. It's a problem because they're deciding which corporations get the investments. They're deciding who is able to accumulate wealth in our country, and with wealth comes power. And with wealth also comes investment in nonprofits. So nonprofits are being invested in primarily by old white men as well. We need to change that if we want to change the trajectory of our country.
So it sounds as though you're doing a lot of traveling around the world.
Well, so, okay, so we hold governments accountable, we hold corporations accountable, but we feel like if we are successful on both of those and we don't have the next generation of human rights defenders, it'll be for naught. So our third big program is our human rights education program called Speak Truth to Power, something you know so much about, Diane, because you've been doing that your whole life. But we teach about 1.2 million students per year, kindergarten through law school, about the concept of human rights, about social-emotional learning, and train them to make a difference in their classrooms, communities, and countries.
Carrie, you must be one busy woman.
Have a great staff.
Carrie Kennedy, and I want to thank you so much, and I really hope to see your mother before long. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Let's take a break, then we'll be back with an interview from our archives with one of Bobby Kennedy's biographers.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. In 2000, I spoke with journalist and author Evan Thomas about his book, Robert Kennedy, His Life. Kennedy was known as a champion of civil rights, and one of the stories people often tell is about how in 1960, he got Martin Luther King released from prison.
Good morning, Evan. It's good to see you.
Hi, Diane.
Thomas says the story is a bit more complicated than people think, and helps us to better understand Bobby Kennedy.
This is a very interesting story. There's a whole legend that grew up that, this is terribly important, by getting Martin Luther King released from jail in the fall of 1960, the Kennedys won the black vote and changed politics forever. The black vote had been Republican, and by winning the black vote, arguably, the Kennedys won the 1960 election, and they did it by getting King out of jail. Well, the myth always was that Bobby Kennedy, King had been held on some minor, frivolous, ridiculous charge, and the legend always was that Bobby, in a moment of moral impetuosity, picked up the phone, called the judge, and said, release him. Well, Bobby was morally impetuous, but that's not all that was going on by any means. It turns out that he called the governor of Georgia, Jack and Bobby's, spoke to the governor of Georgia and fixed the deal to get him out. And the governor of Georgia, Governor Vandiver, who was a segregationist, didn't want anybody to know that he was doing this. He just wanted to make the embarrassment go away. He didn't want to have a fractious scene. So he played ball with the Kennedys, and it was the governor who told the judge to let King out. So it wasn't just this sudden moment of picking up the phone and saying, you know, you're doing the wrong thing, Judge. It was much more politically connived and done through a back channel.
Well, but are you saying that Bobby felt it would be politically expedient?
Yes.
For him, for his brother, for the election?
I think the real point is that he felt both things.
Yeah.
I mean, Bobby, the key to understanding Bobby Kennedy is that it's possible for human beings to be good and bad, to be honest and devious all at once. You don't have to be all of one thing. And Bobby was particularly a mixed bag, ultimately, I think, for the better. This is a sympathetic biography. I think Bobby Kennedy was in many ways a great man who kept on trying and did a lot of good things. But he had a pretty rough side to him. And this is an illustration of him. He thought it was politically expedient to get King out of jail, partly so they wouldn't just have some awful showdown in which Nixon would come down and posture and the Kennedys would be seen to be siding with the segregationists, keeping him into jail. There was a political side to that. And at the same time, there was just a moral feeling that King was getting a bad deal and that that wasn't fair.
But, you know, as you say that, it seems to me that every single important decision that an elected official makes or a candidate makes is perforce based on that kind of, you know, moral decision on the one side, political decision, whatever works, let's do it.
I suppose that's true. But one thing about the Kennedys is everything they do is slightly larger than life.
Yeah.
I mean, it is what you're saying is generally true, but the Kennedys did it on such a grand scale.
Now, what kind of a campaign do you think Bobby ran?
A fascinating, wonderful campaign, especially compared to today's rather over-polled, over-cautious.
You're part of the polling.
I am part of the problem. The press is part of the problem. But Bobby ran a very kind of emotional, elemental campaign. In fact, this is interesting to me. They had to tone it down. Bobby was so effective at getting people to go crazy in the streets that they wrote intentionally dull speeches for him so that he wouldn't make the crowd go too nuts. I mean, can you imagine today a politician having to tone down his speeches because the crowd was too enthusiastic?
But, I mean, this seems so like an antithesis to his own personality.
Yeah, but people sensed in Bobby a vulnerability. And we talk about authenticity today.
Yes.
People could feel in Bobby mm-hmm. Kennedy that he had a genuine empathy for them, even though he'd been
really
a rich kid
cared.
And all that. But they could sense in his halting manner, in his quavery voice, in his kind of mournful countenance, and in the kind of fire that you could sort of feel within him, that he was the real thing, that he really did care about him. And that was true, that he did. I mean, they weren't imagining something.
Finally, let's take one last listen to the words of Robert F. Kennedy. Here he is again, speaking in Indianapolis after the assassination of Martin Luther King.
The vast majority of white people and the vast majority of black people in this country want to live together, want to improve the quality of our life, and want justice for all human beings that abide in our land. And what dedicate ourselves to what the Greeks wrote so many years ago, to tame the savageness of man and make gentle the life of this world. Let us dedicate ourselves to that and say a prayer for our country and for our people. Thank you very much.
That's all for this week. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org, or leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851, and go to our website, dianereem.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden. Comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman, Sandra Baker, and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week are Douglas Bell and Natalie Urev-Lifker. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Reed.